Multitudinous human hopes and tender aspirations have sailed over the river on that beautiful barge, on that mystic affirmation, which, floating on the flowing sea of the olden time, comes very near to our hearts today, not valuable because it is laden with priestly authority, but because it comes endorsed by the spiritual discoveries and positive facts of the last 15 years. In my father's house there are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you, how tender and beautiful, how simple and true, how childlike and sublime. The earth is the land of winter, of storms and sorrows, but the second sphere is the summer land of repose and infinite blossoming. Many apartments in the summer land for different peoples and races of men. Various localities and spheres for different inclinations. Provision is made for the complete gratification of the diversities of spiritual desires in human character, so that all races and all states of mind will be at home in the Father's house which is eternal in the heavens, friendly brotherhoods all, though billions, trillions of leagues apart. Whose heart does not beat in melodious harmony with that beautiful sentiment from the intuitions of long ago, with that ever dear and lovingly sweet affirmation from the source of positive revelation. It comes clad with the majestic authority in which all truth travels to mankind. It stamps the spirit with an inward conviction of eternal reality. On this globe there are high mountains yet utter strangers to human footsteps. Those grand old monuments of matter, with their tops perpetually cloud-veiled, have been for centuries innumerable unknown to human intelligence and contemplation. Storms are beneath their lofty summits. No man's foot has pressed their dizzy heights. The tempests are lower down. So our mariners report of storms on the vast oceans. But down deep in the waters all is still, high enough in the air, all is calm. The middle ground is where the fierce battles of the elements are fought. The conflicting powers meet and pass each other, never to meet again. Sometimes they meet and fight with such terrible energy as, for the moment, to shake the neighboring earth and cause the bending heavens to tremble as though they were to be rolled together as a scroll. And yet deep enough in the inanimate apartments of the physical world all is still and peaceful, high enough in the ethereal space all is equally silent and without commotion. Indeed, so perfectly still is the air above at a certain height, that the stroke of a hammer on a log's end could be heard from New York to California. The slightest accent of the human voice could be there heard for hundreds of miles. Persons might converse with the Atlantic between them, in a voice not louder than is usual, if they were high enough up in this ethereal realm. The sun that shines with such glory and splendor, distributing warmth and fertilization over the earth's bosom, playing so sweetly and tenderly with the flowers and laughing with the rivers that come flowing down from the mountains, exerts no influence upon this upper sky region. Go up 15 to 20 miles, and you find utter night, notwithstanding the noontide glory and blaze of the sun's rays on the face of the earth. The effect of the sun's rays is altogether terrestrial, not atmospherical, that is, the manifestation of its light and warmth is attributable more to mundane than to solar causes. The wonders of the physical atmosphere, within the 50 miles, would be a tax upon anyone's faith. And yet I ask you to ascend in your thoughts millions and billions of miles beyond our Earth's atmosphere. In the physical world you find works and wonders inexpressible. How expressive of the spiritual grandeur and omnipotence of the infinite soul! How can you but be filled with adoration and most glorious contemplations when the celestial truth is brought to your mind, that in the Father's house are many mansions? If it were not so, the seers and mediums would have told you. Let us think of the physical aspect of the summer land. Many persons have understood me to have said that it is a globe. I do not mean to be so understood. The beautiful land, as I have frequently seen it, and as many have testified concerning it, is a solid belt of land, or zone, round in form like the tire of a wheel, but it is not a globe, is not spherical nor inhabitable in all directions. Imagine a belt extending above the earth 2/3 of the distance from the sun, and say 70 millions of miles wide. Imagine that belt to be immeasurably larger than the sun's path around Alcyone in the deep of immensity. Suppose this belt to be open at the sides, and filled with worlds and crowned with stars and suns, and overhead and all around a firmament just like these heavens above the earth. Look in that direction and you will see just what you see on earth, only everything further unfolded and more perfect. There is exhibited the perfections of the plans of the infinite temple which here is only fractional and fragmentary. Thus you may somewhat imagine the appearance and shape of the Summerland. What is called the Milky Way is really a belt of suns, and planets, and satellites. There seems also to be branch fields of stars, setting off sidewise from the body of the belt. Then when the telescope is pointed in certain directions, where the unaided human eye can have nothing, there are developed, first nebulae, cloudy regions, next, if the telescope be strong enough, like Lord Rosse's, it reveals the fact that what were supposed to be only star clouds, are immense fields of stars, suns, and lesser bodies. Those star fields open here and there and make a vista, and, looking through, there is revealed a black space which no telescope has yet been able to dissolve. But clairvoyance has made the promise that when the telescopic power is adequate, what now appear to be only empty portions of immensity will turn out to be as full of those orbs as the great meadow is full of spears of grass. There are large islands of atmosphere between the planets. These air islands serve as silken cushions, so to say, to keep the rolling planets supplied with electricity and also to prevent the friction which would exist were all the spaces occupied with worlds. So that there are really atmospheric islands, as I am impressed to term them, as well as immeasurable star systems, in the far-off immensity. Now the Summerland is in harmony with this physical circle of planets called the Milky Way. It is a belt, a zone, or girdle, of real, substantial matter. It is beyond the Milky Way only in the sense of its being far off according to our habits of using language. When liberated at death, we do not move on toward the sun, nor drop downwards into some dreary depth of darkness, we embark on a sidewise voyage, directly above the southern extremity of our planet, and thence onward until we reach the Summerland. What sure do we gain? We gain the sure of a land just like this earth. If this earth were a stratified belt composed of the finest possible particles that you can imagine thrown from all the orbs composing the universes, pulverize and attenuate the finest particles of matter on this earth, then bring them together in chemical relations, make them coalesce and form into an immeasurable golden belt with all the visible suns and stars, and you have the second sphere in its substance, position, and formation. Do you not comprehend that that land is as substantial to those who live there as this earth is to its inhabitants? The proportions and the adaptations are the same. The Summerland, so far as the surrounding immensity is concerned, is bounded on all sides by aerial seas. Suppose you should go down to any of those high points of land along the coast, and look off on the watery expanse of the Atlantic Ocean. What would you see? No islands are visible, only an atmosphere overhead, clouds are floating in the blue sky, and all the rest is water. Now suppose you had never seen, or read, or heard of such a spectacle. What would be your first impression? Your first sensuous impression would be that all the immensity beyond was water, as all above is sky, and that, if you should sail off on that dreary waste, you would be lost utterly to land and to human moiety. Such, I say, would be your impression or apprehension on the supposition that you had no previous knowledge of any such spectacle in nature. Now imagine yourself standing on one of those shining shores on the margin of the Summerland, looking toward the Earth, and Sun, and Mercury, and Venus, what would you see? If you were not a far-seeing clairvoyant, but was contemplating with the first opening of your spiritual eyes, you would see an illimitable ocean of twinkling stars overhead and zones of golden suns shining, and you would realize a holy, celestial atmosphere, bounding your existence on all sides, and from your feet the departure of an ocean without shore or island, without form, and void of all relations. If, however, your clairvoyant sight was opened, if your spiritual eyes had the light of far-penetrating clairvoyance in them, you would instantly perceive that the aerial ocean, which flows out into infinity from your feet, ripples off and divides into beautiful ethereal rivers, and that those rapidly flowing rivers lead away to the planets, even to this earth, whence you departed, while another river flows onward to Mars, another to Jupiter, another to Saturn, and other celestial streams to other more distant planets belonging to other systems of suns, and so on, and on, throughout the star-paved regions of the firmament, you would behold, in every imaginable direction, streams running musically down these gentle atmospheric declivities, just as tangibly as the rivers that run down the mountains and flow through the spaces in the rough landscapes of this more material world. I wish. Oh, how I wish. That I could picture to you the reality of these musical rivers of the heavenly spaces. They are musical to the ear that can hear them flowing between the constellations. Pythagoras and his school believed in the deathless music of the spheres. Did not the students of Pythagoras listen to catch that compound symphony? And was it not this very star melody which caused them to be such enthusiasts in music? Did not some of them in the far-off olden time have clairaudience enough to hear through the physical, and also clairvoyance sufficient to see that in the Father's house there are many mansions, many happy and beautiful places, many apartments or spheres of human life, and that these different apartments in the celestial temple were so many local scenes and landscapes, belonging to the summer land, which breathe eternal harmony throughout infinitude, the music of the spheres? Now suppose you were this moment standing on the shining shore of the summerland and looking this way, the outflowing sea would appear about the same to your sight, without the light of clairvoyance, as would the Atlantic Ocean to the natural eye from the promontories of Nahant. It would, perhaps, at first, be no more of a startling spectacle of incomprehensible sublimity. Very many persons depart every day from this land of winter for the summerland. When they are led through the celestial gardens and down by the shining shores, and when they begin to hear the lapping of musical waves as they ripple in from the very remote planets, bringing upon their throbbing, undulating bosoms, new persons who had but just died, left their gross bodies, on those planets, the scene operates upon them, because yet uninitiated, just as though you were to see spirits with beautiful forms suddenly coming from off the water by the seaside, or persons walking and riding upon the surface of the waters at Nahant, or down here on the ocean near the rocky shores of Long Island. I say the first exhibition astonishes them as much as such a novel scene would surprise you of this world. I will now relate a true story. A little girl, who had lost her darling playmate, dreamed about the summerland. This sweet little weeping dreamer lived in Boston. I knew her well. Death had taken her beautiful mate away. The funeral procession went by the door of her father's house. Her mother owned a cushioned seat in a fashionable church, and of course the little daughter had a fashionable, religious direction given to her thoughts. What were her thoughts on death? She thought all of her little mate was put into the ground, laid low in the cold, loveless earth, and that when the insensate gravel, stones, and chilly soil were thrown from the spades upon the coffin, they covered all that there was of her, and all there would be of her, until that mysterious trump would sound in the resurrection morn, when Jehovah would call those long sleeping jewels that were particularly his own, to himself. Well, little Matty stood weeping by the front window as the pageantry went solemnly through the street toward the green retreats of Mount Auburn. She asked her mother what it all meant. Over and over again the mother answered that they were going to bury the little girl in the ground. This seemed to strike Matty, for the first time, as something horrible to think of. She had, perhaps, never thought seriously of it before. The dread reality of this false view of death never touched her affections till now. She had seen funeral processions, but this particular funeral went out of her saddened heart to the silent cemetery. Hat Mother said that God always did so, it was his own mysterious way. When people die they are put into the ground, then the ground is thrown over them, and the gram and the ages grow over them. When the time comes, they arise from their long sleep and hasten to God, if they are called. If not, you know the rest of the story. Mattie sadly swallowed all this religious error, and shuddered. She was a beautiful girl then, a young lady now. 2 weeks after that funeral, there was a fashionable party in Boston. Mattie received an invitation. Her parents were very rich, and she had gold rings and chains, and many beautiful dresses, but she now wanted another and a more attractive ring, which she had accidentally seen down in Washington Street. It was a splendid ornament. She wanted it in time for the party. Her parents shook their heads and opposed her wishes. They said she had so many ornaments, was always so beautifully dressed, and how elegantly and expensively arranged in her person, she ought not to ask for anything more. It was difficult for parental love to deny her, an only child, but they did, nevertheless, refuse to purchase the ring. Disappointed and grieved, Mattie hastened to her room and thought it over, and on the second day in the afternoon, as her mother chanced to be looking out of the rear window into the garden, she saw the child working away with a little flower spade, digging a small, deep hole in the ground. The mother watched for a while, and then went down to her and said, "Mattie, my child, what are you doing?" Mattie blushed. Already she had deposited in the ground a letter, and was throwing the fresh dirt upon it. She was embarrassed at her mother's question. She feared that she could not quite explain herself. In explanation, she at length confessed that she wanted that letter to go to God. She had secretly written, praying and entreating her Heavenly Father to influence her father and mother so that they would consent to buy that beautiful ring for her. Her plan was to send a letter through the grave to God. Now Mattie got the splendid ring, but I think she was never quite certain whether it came in consequence of having buried the letter or not. She did not then see why a letter could not go to God through the earth. But in the course of the same year, little Mattie had impressed upon her mind a beautiful dream. She told it next morning with a full rose in her cheeks and a new light in her eyes. She saw her playmate. She was in a beautiful place, standing by the side of a great silvery sea. The water was shining and twinkling in every part like a lake of white light. She said it seemed that the sun was sending a golden shimmer through the vast space of glittering waters. Mattie described the scene very finely, and said that her playmate was standing up there and sending kisses to her way down that silvery river. She declared that she felt every kiss as it fell upon her lips. And then she added, "She told me that I need not bury anything to go up there, and that I would myself come there and play with her in that beautiful place." Now this little girl knew nothing whatever of the summer land. I was at that time a great many leagues away, and her mother, whom I knew, was very cautious to never so much as whisper the slightest word favorable to truths of the harmonial dispensation. Visions like Mattie's have been duplicated and triplicated over and over throughout this new country. Of course, they have been modified and varied in a large variety of ways, but the testimony from different minds is invariably the same, viz., that there are up the lands, rivers, mansions in the Father's house, temples of beauty in the home of the living God, that countless people live there as naturally as they do here, with the difference that up there are not the earthly customs, nor this routine of daily fret and fight for physical necessities, neither a continuation of the vexations consequent upon men's spurious desires and appetites. Yes, kisses have been sent down the shining rivers to the lips of many human hearts. A little girl in Bridgeport, in 1853, was moved to utter words of wisdom which only an archangel could authorize. She spoke under a celestial afflatus from the summer land. Fools confound the wise, when the former are under the inspiration of heavenly minds. Thus, sometimes, the most ignorant grow wise in 10 brief minutes. All such mediums and spontaneous sensitives describe rivers of light. This is supposed by materialists to be poetry. They are right, it is poetry. In essence, all poetry is immutable truth, and essentially false imagination is a philosophical impossibility. take the crudest and most grotesque superstitions of the past, and at their deepest heart you will find, if your own ability to discern is deep enough, revelations, pure and undefiled of the realities and inhabitants of the beyond. I have frequently called your attention to the naturalness of the Summerland. Its reality is among the philosophical discoveries of the present outfolding century. The most ancient spiritualists, in the very earliest centuries, be it ever remembered, gave inspired sentences, and made intuitive statements, and wrote fine revelations of these same celestial wonders and post-mundane verities. Let us now contemplate some of the six scenes in the beautiful land. Approaching the shining shore upon one of these silvery rivers, that sets out from the southern extremity of this globe, you behold thousands of pyrodla, or grottos and natural temples of clustering foliage, vines, and flowers, closely resembling lacework chapels. In these peculiar pagodas, or family prayer grottos, you behold persons who still believe in Amun-Ra, the original Egyptian name and conception of the Supreme Being. I have already mentioned that the Egyptians had chosen a star, Guptarian, and that they of long seasons of worship, of joy and festivity, equal to 100 years of restful Sabbaths, or as long as the star of their choice, Guptarian, shines over that particular portion of the Summerland. When the great star, sun, of their destiny sinks out of their sight, they cease their worshipings and festivities and return to other and less religious interests. They are about the same people they were while living in the valley of the Nile, only they are now in a higher Egypt, clothed in spiritual bodies. Many of them continue their old-time worship just as though they would always remain Egyptians. It is marvelous how immobile and persistent are some of the human temperaments. In some races they yield almost nothing in the course of 1,000 years. The prevalence of other opinions, other thoughts, and other conceptions, exert no remodeling effect in some minds. Now many persons think this statement is unreal. Well, look at the Jews of this generation. Are they not still the Jews that they were 1800 years ago? The variations and improvements are very slight. The rabbinates and the Talmudians are the same. Look at their physiognomy, too, and look at the combinations of their characteristics, their inclinations in religion and in trade, and you will find them the same unaltered people. Or, look at the Roman Catholics. You may think that they are greatly modified. No, they are not. There has scarcely been an alteration in them from the first days of their faith. Those who come to this country are occasionally modified by Protestant influences. But the great Catholic establishment is characterized by a constitutional immobility. It is based in the fixed temperaments of those peculiar minds who belong to it. Protestants still revert to the Catholic Church. Such minds belong to the sphere of authority. They believe in religious system, and they seek and find it in the original establishment. They believe that Protestantism is all afloat, that there must be some tying up place, or there will come chaos and destruction in morals and religion. Such persons need some place of discipline and worship where they can hire their thinking done for them, according to authority extending backward over centuries to holy saints and holy fathers whom no Protestant ever undertakes to impeach. In this way, this state of mind becomes fixed and immobile. Now suppose such a person should die, what is the next step? Are such minds instantly changed? Are they ever suddenly remolded from within? True, they are changed from a natural body into a spiritual body in the twinkling of an eye. But are they not the same persons, with the same education, and influenced by their long accustomed thoughts? Many such after death still believe that somewhere, beyond the bright fields of beauty, and even beyond the trials of purgatory, they will find the burning pit. They frequently think that if they should walk off but a few hundred leagues, they would find something worse than purgatory. They naturally enough understand that they are in purgatory, and thus the fact dawns slowly upon them, that they are in their appropriate private places, and are receiving the just discipline of progress in the moral government of God. So these ancient Egyptians, born in the valley of the Nile, strange children of a strange, sandy, symbolic country, erect countless little pyramidalia, or temples of festivity and worship, dedicated to their long-chosen planet Sirius, sometimes called the Dog Star, but up there they name it Gupterian, a large sun in the distant heavens, which our astronomers call a star of the first magnitude. It rises and sets in the firmament over the Summerland once in 27 of our centuries. Suppose a bright orb about one-tenth of the apparent size of our sun, rising and shedding its rays over a particular portion of the beautiful world, and you get a conception of the Star of Destiny in the Egyptian Brotherhood. The pyramidalia are natural vine-draped grottos grouped along the shore of a deep river that branches from the one which flows thither from our globe. You will keep in memory how this earth of ours sends off its main celestial river which flows off southwardly in the upper air, and which, being a magnetic combination of imponderable elements, ascends very gracefully in the channel of its flight, terminating and mingling with the silvery sea that bounds the Summerland. The planet rivers flow through the vast expanse of sea as the Gulf Stream flows through the Atlantic Ocean. Thus through this vast celestial sea of magnetic atmosphere the planetary streams flow directly to the shining shores of the Summerland, but nearest to that shore which is nearest the Earth, and along the inland lake called Mornia, which is filled with attractive islands, you will find these embowered chapels and prayer grottos of the Egyptians. In 1853 I was enabled for the first time to see them. I continued to investigate and to make inquiries until I got at the motive for the cultivation and continuation of these pyramidalia. They said that those fragrant floral structures are little statuettes, or miniature pyramids, dedicated to the celebrated Dog Star, Sirius, or Gupterian, being the accredited home of Amun-Ra. I seem to be impressed with the desire to urge upon your understanding the entire naturalness of the next state of human existence. It seems desirable that you should see that the inhabitants that live in harmonious accord with each other, because of the omniscient system which is adapted to the infinite varieties of human character and consequent diversities of destiny. When you arrive there, and you may embark thither before the end of this year, you will not be a stranger, for you will have cultivated some prescience of the house constructed with different mansions. Have you not had four gleams and intuitions of what I now relate? Have you never had thoughts or impressions, in your dreams and visions of the night, of floating or flying through the air? If the thousands of seeresses and clairvoyants and true dreamers could rise up today and relate their experiences, I should have unimpeachable accumulative testimony, sufficient to overwhelm all the skeptical clergymen and logical lawyers in the wide world. You occasionally read the New Testament, do you not? I suppose that you believe somewhat in the Pentecostal experience which is therein recorded. It seemed that, in that joyful day, they all arose from their seats, and then what? They spoke in unknown tongues. Of course unknown tongues were tongues not understood. The manifestation must have been gibberish and fanatical to those who witnessed and recorded the circumstances. Suppose that in these days there should be a public repetition of that ancient spiritual experience. Instantly some mediums would begin to discourse in Persian, others in Indian, others in Chinese, others in Japanese, others in Latin, others in Greek. Would it not be all Greek to the most of us, and more especially to spectators and non-sympathizing minds? What would we say? And what would the people say? This, give us something that we can all understand. Yes, that would be the popular demand. But just step back into the New Testament and read the statement over again. In Pentecostal times or seasons there was a general uprising or condescension of the celestial spirit. The Spirit of the Lord was poured out without stint. Of course you know that every sweet or powerful influence from the firmament was called there, Spirit of the Lord. Influences from the concentrated minds of millions in the Summerland could cause the largest human audience to rise to their feet in an instant. Then would occur manifestations according to individual gifts. Some would exercise the magnetic power and make passes over the sick, Others would hasten off on sweet missions of mercy, some would declaim in unknown tongues, while others would fall prostrate and swoon into a trance, and physicians would say, "Oh, that is only excitement and hysteria." And all this would be analogous, identical, with what you so reverently read in your testament. Now, if this Bible statement be true, it is interesting and applicable to us only just so far as it is known and corroborated by spiritual experience in the manifestations of these days.